Thank you, Walt. This would be my opportunity to thank you for all the careful arrangements you've made, transportation and food and all the rest, to get us here, us speakers, and see to it that we were taken care of. And I think we've all enjoyed it. I certainly want to say thanks. Now, I'm beginning to have that sort of feeling that most of you have when we get toward the end of a conference, and you begin to feel, well, that's all been great, it's been exciting, but when I get back, what's waiting there, and what kinds of problems have been put on the shelf, just waiting till you get back to cope with them. And that feeling is one that I want to address this morning in terms of the future of the church, because we can speak a lot about our mission, a vision that we have for the future, but there's also a sense in which every one of us feels, I think, that there's a little something nibbling at the edges of our consciousness, worry about the future for the church. It lies just below the surface of most of what we do, but now and then we read a statistic or we check over something in our own congregation's life and begin to wonder what the future will bring. Words like secularism, indifference, conflict, mobility, inflation, indifference, and so on are words that we don't like to hear too much, but we recognize will have an effect on the way the church can minister in the future. And I want to address as frontally as I can this morning that feeling, that unease about how long we'll be able to hold the dikes, whether it will be us or our children that will finally be overwhelmed by a mass of secularism, a rising tide of indifference to the church. In this part of the country particularly, you have experienced that much more than Lutherans in some other parts of the country where some of the cultural walls are still fairly high. And so I want to talk about that stress that all of us feel and some of us experience and ask, can we cope and what will the future be like? Now, of course, we Lutherans ought to be good at coping with crises like that because we've had a lot of experience in our history in this country. I want to look back first at the way we were. I want to talk about four traumas through which we have passed and recognize that traumas continue to hit us all the time. I read recently in a newspaper the following from a pastor. Haven't we suffered enough from innovation already not to start up something new so soon? Many of us remember what the new hymnal did, and we hear complaints about our new service, so don't let's go too fast. I'm sure you've all heard similar worries. That was written in 1889. Appeared in the February 7th Lutheran Visitor for that year. I read old newspapers fairly frequently. It was actually at the dentist's office there in Decorah where we... But as we look back, the history of our life in this country has not been an easy one. I want you to try to imagine, if you can, the feeling of Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, who was mentioned this morning, as he stepped off the boat in 1742 as a missionary to the English colonies and began to discover how different church life was here from what he had known. I want to look particularly first at establishment, because that is a crisis that most of us have so far behind us that we forget what a devastating problem it was for early Lutherans who came to this country. Those who came in the colonial period came from Swedish Church, from Church of Germany, where Lutheranism was established. And we, of course, today think about establishment as really archaic and probably dangerous. But the persons who lived in it and worked in it saw it as essentially the only way to do things. Think for a minute what it would be like in your parish if all the salaries of the staff were cared for so that the congregational contributions did not have to pay any salaries. Then suppose that the upkeep of the building, in fact the building itself, but all of its renovation and repair, painting, all of its utilities, all the current operating expenses, in other words, were also cared for, so that the congregation did not bear that burden either. Then add to that the fact that all the contributions that the congregation made could go directly to benevolent causes, to the poor, to missions, to orphanages, and so on. Add to that the fact that every youth would receive education in Scripture and in the Catechism, every youth in public schools, so that all those concerns for religious history were cared for. And not general religious history either, but Lutheran catechism. As you can see, there were many, many advantages to such a system, and to come to a country suddenly where you were not the established church, as Lutherans were not, was indeed a frightening thing. But interestingly enough, the thing that worried Muhlenberg most was not the lack of financial support, but the lack of control over clergy. The other thing that the establishment did, of course, was screen out the qualified persons so that only those who had been properly trained, duly called, would serve in congregations. When Muhlenberg came to this country, as you know, there were a large number of so-called vagabond preachers who moved from place to place, and when a congregation on the frontier saw them coming, the congregation would ask, well, where is your ordination certificate? And the individual would say, oh, we had such a terrible storm when we came across the Atlantic. My chest with all of its belongings was washed overboard, and I landed penniless. But thanks to friends, God's help, I've been able to wear these clothes and earn my daily bread, and I've now come to preach God's word among you. Well, 9 times out of 10 it worked, and the people would accept this individual at face value. And then, within a few months, after some money had been transferred and some perquisites gained, the real character of the individual would come out, and there would be some problem with funds or some immorality or some public drunkenness, and the next morning the preacher would be gone and the congregation would be torn apart. Muhlenberg saw this again and again, and he longed for some authority which could say and certify that an individual clergy was authentic and properly trained. So what did he do? He turned to the only source he knew. He turned to the governor of the colony, Robert Morris. I want to just read to you Muhlenberg's appeal, part of it simply because I think it points out the quandary Muhlenberg found himself in and why he appealed to the governor of the state. There are many, he said, whom we shall never get rid of until our gracious superiors, that's the authorities, the establishment, until our gracious superiors are pleased to demand proper credentials of all who exercise the ministry, and no longer suffer vagabonds to laugh at us who are regular clergymen by saying, it's a free country. You may have wondered where that statement originated. And of course, the other problem, in addition to the fact that one could not control the quality of ministry, was the fact that it was a voluntary support system, and therefore it was not possible to have the freedom of preaching that was exercised in Germany. Now, I say freedom. We always think of the fact that an established church is very rigid toward its clergy. That's sometimes true. But you also know that a congregation can be very rigid toward its preachers as well. And that was what Muhlenberg discovered. He wrote back to Halle soon after he got here about trying to relate to persons in a congregation and to preach judgment occasionally. If we come too close to their consciences, they let loose and cry, what right does this parson have to order me about? Of course, I pay him by the year. If he does not preach according to my liking, I'll go to another church and get my preaching for nothing. One might say they would get what they paid for, too, perhaps. But you are familiar with that same syndrome. If he does not preach according to my liking, I'll go to another church and get my preaching for nothing, or sometimes for paying a lot. But they will move in order to receive the kind of ministry they feel they need to hear. Now, that problem, that sudden challenge for quality of clergy, for a consistent and strong ministry that could deal with people directly and not fear the power of the purse. And then all of the financial problems that I've mentioned earlier, those challenges all were met within an established system. And therefore, it was extremely difficult for the pioneers in this country to break from that system and to adjust to the new way of doing things here. Of course, there were also problems with establishment, and the main one was that one became more dependent on the government than on the word. There was in England a wag who took the doxology and rewrote it to describe that situation. Praise tax from which all blessings flow. Praise tax all preachers here below. Praise tax above ye heavenly host, for while it flows, the church can coast. And in fact, that's what Muhlenberg and others discovered, that it was possible to develop a voluntary church system independent of establishment in which the individual believer was more fully invested than she or he had ever been in the system in Europe. It unleashed a really new level of lay activity in this country, which the next generations would see blossom into a whole host of voluntary societies to do all kinds of missionary and social labor. It brought personal commitment back into religion, and the groups that grew most rapidly in those early years in the United States were groups like the Methodists who made a point of personal commitment and in fact built their missionary system on that structure. And it was the established churches that began to languish and fail. You may remember that Congregationalism was one of the chief religious options in colonial America, but in the United States after the Revolution, it soon faded and became a small relic of its former power and self. So the first trauma was to overcome the concept of establishment. Now, many Lutherans came after that period and did not go through that first one, but I wanted to mention it because it was indeed a crisis. It was an adjustment which forced the church out of its comfortable past and into a very uncertain and uncomfortable present. The second trauma is one, though, that all of our forebears experienced, and that was the trauma of language, the loss of the language of the parents. Once again, we who use English fully and almost exclusively, perhaps, have a hard time recognizing the strangeness that a foreign language created for those who came from Europe and lived in that kind of context for, in some cases, generations. It became a real bond with the mother country. It was not only a tie to the folks back in Europe, the common language, it was at the same time a channel for all the traditions, the prayers, the scriptures, the devotional literature, the catechisms were all written in the languages of Europe. And somehow, when they were translated into English, they never really sounded right. Just take the word Geist, for example, in German. There's no way that it's possible to translate that effectively and fully into English. And so it's quite true that to lose the language of the parents was indeed to be a loss. There was something deep that would have to be sacrificed. And therefore, the church, with all the strength it had, tried to hold on to the language as long as possible. The Pennsylvania Ministerium, which was set up by Muhlenberg in order to provide some control on clergy, also produced a liturgy, revised it in 1786 after the Revolution, because it wanted now to have a church for the new land, and its general prayer had a petition that ran as follows: "Inasmuch as it has pleased thee," speaking to God, "chiefly by means of the Germans, to transform this state into a blooming garden and this desert into pleasant pasturage," and we're talking about Pennsylvania, "help us not to deny our nationality, but to endeavor that our dear youth may be so educated that German churches and schools may not only be preserved, but may attain a still more flourishing condition." Now note the word, the adjective was not Lutheran. Was German. that German churches and schools may not only be preserved, but may attain a still more flourishing condition. It was, in fact, not the confessions in those days, but the language that they felt would most strongly preserve the traditions that they brought with them. The Evangelical Magazine, a German language magazine published in early 1800s, had in one of its quarterly editions, 1813, the following comment. A German who becomes an Englishman, a worthy man once told me, is like a silkworm who works himself out of his fine, safe home, becomes a butterfly, flutters around, and perishes. Well, better stay in the safe cocoon of German than to flutter around for a while in the furbelows and fripperies of English, only soon to perish. Not, of course, to die, but simply to be cut off from the life-sustaining and giving traditions. Muhlenberg, interestingly enough, and many other of the early pioneers, saw language not as this kind of prop, but rather as a bridge. Muhlenberg argued from the beginning, and as was said this morning at breakfast, taught in Dutch and English, as well as his native German, just because he believed that language had to be a bridge to the next generation. It was, in fact, the dear youth that prayer talked about. It was the dear youth that forced the church inexorably to move toward English in order to carry on with the next generation. It was not going to preserve the next generation by preserving the language. I have mentioned here the experience of Muhlenberg, but of course the Scandinavians had exactly the same situation. In fact, a Norwegian was probably carried on longer and more successfully in this country than any other of the imported languages, partly because World War I did not damage the use of Norwegian the way it called German into question, and maybe also partly because the Norwegians just didn't want to budge. You may have heard the story where the old Norwegian councilman was finally asked, "Well, don't you believe that God understands English?" "Yeah," he said, "he understands it, but he doesn't like it." And so in parish after parish, that battle had to be fought out, and it was always the same argument. If we lose the language, we lose the religion. If we lose the language, we sacrifice the tradition. Therefore, we must hold it. And in parish after parish, they discovered that it was possible to give up the language and that the faith, in fact, did not die. Now we are faced with a situation in this country where many of us may again have to learn a second language in order to minister to people who are coming into this country from linguistic traditions, particularly Hispanic, where they are going through the same thing that our forebears went through. And while we hope devoutly that in time they too will make the transition to English, it's going to be significant that in the meantime some way of ministering to them is found. It's interesting that when the Germans came over in the previous century, it was those groups who developed German language missions that were most successful in helping those people make the transition to American life. And those groups were not normally Lutheran religious groups. They were others. So it's important to, perhaps for many of us, to think about language now no longer as a protection from the faith of the past, but as a bridge to move into new ministries. There's a delightful story about language that's told of a New York mouse who had come in from the country to the big city and no sooner got there than was set upon by an enormous cat. The mouse ran for a crack in the pavement, dashed in and sat there huddled, could hear the pad-pad of the cat's feet outside, and then the silence. Waited and waited, wondering when the cat would go away. Finally, the mouse heard a dog bark close by and reasoned, where there's a dog, the cat will flee. So, having heard the dog bark, the mouse scurried out of his hiding place only to be pounced on by the cat. "Aha, my little friend," the cat said. "You will have to learn that to survive in this city, you must become bilingual." Well, we survived. We made it. We passed over the barrier or across the bridge of language and discovered that indeed by speaking English, we did not lose the traditions of the past. We, in fact, made ourselves available to a much wider group of persons in this country. But then a third trauma. And this is one through which, well, some of you here have passed through the language crisis. That is, in your lifetimes, you perhaps were even confirmed in German or Swedish or Norwegian. But almost all of us have experienced this third trauma and its possibilities and fears, and that's the cultural trauma. Sure, we lost the language. We no longer use those languages in our services, but we still have the sort of Lutheran aura about us, the cultural trappings. And you talk about Lutefisken Lefse, or you talk about sauerkraut, or you talk about coffee, or whatever it may be, and it conjures up a part of what it means to be Lutheran. This cultural cradle is in many senses still with us, and many parts of the country still enjoy that comfort. I met a man from, I mean, you think of Lutherans basically as being Midwestern or Pennsylvania. I met a man from a small town in South Carolina called Peak, and he told me that he didn't know until he was 21 that there were anything in the world but Lutherans and black people, because everybody in his town was Lutheran or black. But none of the blacks were Lutheran, and all of the whites were. Now, that's a cultural cradle, because there was a time when the South Carolina Synod had at least one quarter of its members as black members. But that had been so fully stamped out of human memory by 1950 that persons never realized that such an interracial church had existed in that state up to 1863. But the cultural cradle means that when people move, they still, in some cases, have looked for Lutherans. They have searched out the Schultzes and the Andersons, the Olsons, the Rugens, the Haugens, and all the rest here and there across the western part of the country and in the south and southeast. And where they have found people of like background, they have established congregations. Many of you serve congregations that were started by people who moved out from the Midwest and found like-minded people and said, hey, let's have a church so we can have those good church suppers like we used to have in Iowa or Minnesota again. Now, that's not all, of course, but there is indeed that strong element of a natural audience, common values, a social life and contact that make it comfortable to be with folks like us. And as long as there are folks like us, then we'll go to that church. I talked last night about Congregation A, and a lot of people who are in Congregation A, as I said, are there for social reasons. And I think that it's simply a human characteristic. We mustn't try to react against it, but we must recognize that in every group there is this power of gravity that pulls towards some kind of common denominator and makes it very difficult to reach out to those different, to those strange, to those not, quote, like us. And yet we're doing it, and we're doing it in this part of the country. We're doing it in the West Coast generally. We're doing it in the Southeast and the Southwest. And so we're discovering that, in fact, it's really great to discover persons within the Lutheran family who have not shared all those common roots and those common last names. That, in fact, they bring a new dimension, a sense of strength and very often special skills and a personal commitment, because they have come into the Lutheran Church for reasons far different from those that genetically have programmed many of us to that denominational system. Now, what that means is that there is an increased personal stake involved. It's not the language, it's not the culture. It's basically a personal decision. And if there's anything that seems to me to be crucial for the years ahead, it is the fact that religion will become more and more a matter not of social convention, but of personal conviction. Nicholas Berdyaev wrote many years ago a statement which I've found so prophetic as I've seen what's happened in the last 20 and 30 years. He wrote, "There is no longer any room in the world for a merely external form of Christianity based upon custom. The world is entering upon a period of catastrophe and crisis when we will be forced to take sides, and in which a higher and more intense kind of spiritual life will be demanded from Christians. And I wonder if the concern for spirituality, for formation that we see so often, is not in a sense a present-day replacement for the formation that all of us, many of us, received culturally through our linguistic and national traditions. Without those, we sense that there must be some other way to form our life. And fortunately, many of us are beginning to discover that it is in a lifestyle, a spirituality, a way of living that we can find that new cultural identity and form, indeed, a culture within American culture. But there's one more trauma, and that's one that's going on right now, and many of us feel it in our own homes. It's the shrinking of the family circle. I don't need to rehearse for you the many statistics about the fact that the traditional family seems to be the exception rather than the rule. I simply want to call attention to some interesting facts that were discovered a few years ago in that study of generations made about Lutherans. It does not talk about the fact that families are breaking up. That's what we talk about all the time. But it discovered, as it talked to persons in the younger strata, the younger generation, that their friendships were simply not being made anymore among the traditional Lutheran family circles. People in the age group 24 to 29, for example, said by over half that none of their five closest friends were members of their congregation. That is, that the family circle is no longer tied to the congregational circle. And a still higher percentage, 73%, said that there are no Lutherans said that there was at least one or more non-Lutheran in their immediate family. That is, that that a sister, a brother, a son, or a daughter had moved out of the Lutheran tradition and was now a member of another congregation. 73%. Now that means that the old tradition that remember, there were books about High as the Wall, for example, that one could marry a Catholic and hope to live a happy life. And there were all kinds of admonishments given to try to keep folks marrying people like us so that, again, the genetic line would remain strongly Lutheran. Well, that has, I think, not vanished, but has lost much of its force. There is still the tug in many of us to say, well, it sure would be nice if. But on the other hand, many of us have discovered the joy of relating to young people from other religious traditions within our family and discovering that they again bring a freshness and a vigor, and that the gospel is indeed not restricted to those of us who brought it many, many generations ago from some European background. But this change in family life has indeed threatened us, and it will continue to do so. And it will mean that simply because dad and mom were Lutheran is not going to mean that sis and brother are going to be Lutheran. Or because one of the married couple is Lutheran, somehow the other will then find her or his way into the Lutheran church. Well, what does it all add up to? Well, it all adds up to the fact that we have been through at least four major traumas and are still going through some of the last of those. That as we do so, more and more, the burden for faith and decision is laid on the individual, the believer. As that happens, it's more and more important that the church be able to address the believer where she or he is making that decision and not assume that all these extra religious forces are going to do the job for us. In other words, in a sense, we have been liberated. Little by little, we have moved out of some of the bondages that held us. We were, in fact, enslaved to things that gave promise of keeping the church together, the state, the language, the culture, the family. But every one of them is indeed a crutch, an emergency measure, a security blanket, a teddy bear, if you will, that we cling to because we have become convinced that we couldn't live without them. That all sounds very inspirational and upbeat. But how do you and I feel when we see that baptized membership in our church body is declining? Are we just whistling in the dark when we talk about hope in a culture where more people know their astrological sign than know what church they belong to? How many blows can the church absorb? How much neglect can it tolerate? When do we reach the point where no more cards can be pulled out of the castle without bringing the whole structure down? We've been through a lot of crises. How many more can we face? Well, of course, I have played a little trick on us this morning. I have made the window very small. I started with the... And God has showed us again and again that we can. Now, that all sounds very inspirational and upbeat. But how do you and I feel when we see that baptized membership in our church body is declining? Are we just whistling in the dark when we talk about hope in a culture where more people know their astrological sign than know what church they belong to? How many blows can the church absorb? How much neglect can it tolerate? When do we reach the point where no more cards can be pulled out of the castle without bringing the whole structure down? We've been through a lot of crises. How many more can we face? Well, of course, I have played a little trick on us this morning. I have made the window very small. I started with the establishment, with the church in Europe as it was in the 18th century, and then have moved gradually through the 19th and 20th and shown how one by one certain crutches were taken away. But the European establishment, as every one of us knows, was the exception in Christian history, not the rule. Christianity is and always has been characteristically a missionary religion, challenging local pagan establishments and winning its converts one by one, often breaking the family circle in order to bring people into the Christian family. The question then should never be, can Christianity exist without the support of family, culture, and state? The real question is, can Christianity ever exist when it relies on the support of family, culture, or state? Christianity has spread precisely in conflict with established cultures and even family circles. As we look ahead, it may be our privilege and our awesome task once again to enter the conflict of the missionary situation here in Christian America. I am confident, though, that if we enter that situation, and we are in a sense already there, if we carry it out with prayer and faithfulness, we will discover that we won't win them all. We will not, in fact, perhaps be as fat as we have been, but we may discover that we will be truer to what our Lord wishes of us, and we may serve our country better because we will provide an alternative. We will provide a new way of looking at world, at work, at women and men, and at ourselves. It's not going to be an easy job. It's already at our door, particularly your door here in the Northwest. But seen in the right light, it is indeed God's work, and in the truest sense, the way the church must go. God bless you as you pursue that task.